Well, howdy there, stranger. I'm Jordy.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome back to Beers with Queers, the true crime podcast where I research a case and Brad here, and potentially you guys,
don't know a damn thing about it.
So happy April, everybody. Hopefully you guys had an awesome Easter weekend. And if you didn't celebrate Easter, hopefully you just had an awesome weekend. You know, it feels like March went on for a long, long time, actually. I think that's just because we were nonstop busy the whole month. We were out of town every single weekend. We were in Nashville, then D.C., then D.C., then Horror Hound up in Cincinnati. And then we actually did an underwear show this past weekend. So needless to say, it was very fun, but we are ready for things to chill out a little bit and relax a little bit.
To me, it didn't seem long at all. It actually seemed like one big, long week. Well, not long week. It went by so fast. I'm like, where did March go?
That is fair. Sometimes it felt like it went on forever, and then sometimes it felt like it was a blink and you'll miss it moment. But either way, it was super fun. Super awesome month. It was my birthday month, and it was all that I could ask for and more. So here's to hoping 27 treats me as good as 26. So with that, let's get into today's case, because this is going to be a very historical and often long forgotten piece of queer history that more people need to know about. Now, all the information presented in this episode was obtained through the book Sex Crime Panic, A Journey to the Paranoid Heart of the 1950s by Neil Miller. Now, outside of this very detailed research Neil did for his book, I have never seen this case covered or talked about anywhere else, despite how shocking, brutal, and just all-around tragic it was. It's a case of a small, all-American town that is gripped with fear following the horrific murders of several children in the area and the mass hysteria, panic, and outrage that soon followed. Now, what started out as a genuine search for the killers in order to bring them to justice soon turned into what can only be described as a modern-day Salem witch trials, as police began to round up and accuse anyone they suspected of being a sexual deviant, which was, of course, their favorite term to call anyone they believed to be gay. Now, this is one of those cases that will enrage you the more you read about it, but one that is also so important to remember, especially in this day and age when gay people, trans people, and drag queens are just getting accused of some of the most heinous things you can think of, even though it's quite literally not true. And so it's just one of those cases where it really shows you that this has been an issue for almost a century at this point. And that's why it's very important to remember cases like these, especially historical ones from like the 50s and the 40s, because it lets us know that, honestly, it's not that quite different from 2024. It's just got a different face on it. So before we get too deep into the story, I think it's important to briefly touch on the social and political climate towards queer people in America during the 1950s. Now, of course, it wasn't good at all. I mean, we all know that. But the 50s were a particularly hard time to be queer in America, more so than any other recent time period up to that point. It was the height of persecution for thousands of gay people all over the country, and a time where every ridiculous law on the books banning homosexuality was enforced to the highest penalty of law. It was a time when great emphasis was put on quote-unquote positive moral and American values, and the nuclear family was the ultimate goal for people to strive for. You know, a mom, a dad, kids, and a white picket fence. It was really the time when the American dream started to form, and it became the ultimate thing, like, this is your goal in life, is to strive for all these things. And the nuclear family was the ultimate goal for people. Now, part of keeping up this appearance of the perfect all-American family life was for government officials and citizens alike to keep an eye out for any sort of deviance to this formula. This was the years immediately following World War II and the Cold War, which was in full force by 1950. And it was during this time that espionage was a major concern for U.S. government. And there was a sense of paranoia and dread that lingered over the entire country as everyone became suspicious of each other and wondered if their neighbors may in fact be a spy or a communist. This came to a head when a little-known Wisconsin senator at the time, named Joseph McCarthy, came forward and claimed to have a list of 200 well-known card-carrying communists at the time that were all employed by the United States government. Now, I'm sure most of y'all are probably familiar, if you're from the United States, you're probably familiar with the name McCarthy, because I would argue that his name is the most synonymous with this time period in terms of politics. Of course, along with other such names as FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, and of course, President Dwight Eisenhower. But McCarthy quickly made a name for himself across America as being a man who was not afraid to get his hands dirty. He led a critical crusade with help from Hoover to snuff out any secret communists working in the government, on top of accusing multiple high-profile celebrities and activists of being communists and spies. Now, this period of time became known as the Second Red Scare, or better known as McCarthyism. Now, although his claims weren't entirely unfounded, as there were several legitimate spies amongst the United States government at this time, so he wasn't completely wrong, but many people now understand that, for the most part, McCarthy used America's paranoia and fear by accusing all of his political opponents of being communists as a way to further his own career, and it worked. Now, on top of the fear of communists, McCarthy knew that there was something else he could use to further his career, something Americans were just as terrified of as communists, and that was homosexuals. So in February of 1950, McCarthy tells a United States Senate committee of whispers about a secret society of homosexuals working and operating inside of the government. Now, this news leads to a massive moral panic across the country, and McCarthy leads the charge in hunting out and identifying every government official of being a homosexual and arresting them in an event that would become known as the Lavender Scare. Now, we're actually going to do a whole episode on this event because it's wild, so I'll leave it at that for right now. But if you do want to watch something that covers this whole scandal, you should watch Fellow Travelers on Showtime or Paramount Plus if you have it. Really good show, absolutely beautiful, and it is really accurate to how life was for homosexuals during the 1950s.
Yeah, I've seen people like comment on it. Could you imagine if this was real?
And it's like, this was real.
Yeah, it's so crazy. The laws were so crazy and everything that people nowadays would think, there's no way this is like The Handmaid's Tale or something. But no, it was reality.
And it was. And that's the thing, too, is, you know, a lot of people, I'm sure, like, you have to look at it from a 1950s perspective, not a 2024 perspective. Of course, that probably wouldn't happen today. But back then, it was common. You know, they wouldn't bat an eye just to persecute some random government official for possibly being a homosexual. Of course, there was really no way to prove it. But all it took was someone to accuse you of being a homosexual, and that was pretty much it. So again, kind of like the Salem witch trials. Now, the scare lasts for a good majority of the 50s and helps further spread a fear of secret homosexuals across the country as laws begin getting more strict and enforced to help deal with the quote-unquote overwhelming problem of sexual perverts. Now, up to this point, gay people were still being grouped with addicts and sex workers, but now people were starting to realize that homosexuals could be anyone. They held positions of power, they were doctors, lawyers, barbers, and you would have no idea unless they told you, and that terrified people. In 1953, President Eisenhower signed Executive Order 10450. Now, this order states that sexual orientation was grounds to fire any government employee and bar them from ever holding a federal job as they were deemed a security risk for being homosexual. Now, under this order, over 5,000 government officials lost their jobs, with some being charged with sexual deviancy, which was a felony at that time. Now, this order would not be repealed completely until 2017 by President Obama as his last act as president. So, of course, the language changed over the years, like in the 90s and the 80s. It first started getting changed in 1974, so that's still a 20-year gap. But it didn't completely, like, the whole order didn't get thrown out the window until 2017.
Thanks, Obama.
And
I mean it. Thanks, Obama.
Yeah, thank you, Obama. Now, on top of this, the Post Office Service began to inspect people's mail and scan it for any signs of homosexual material, and the United States Army dishonorably discharged over 100,000 servicemen from their ranks for being potential homosexuals. So, I think hopefully that gives you guys an idea that this was a very hostile time to be gay in America. And by the mid-50s, paranoia was at an all-time high, and everyone was on the lookout for any sort of deviance that they thought wanted to disrupt their perfect way of life. So, that really gives you a sense of the kind of environment we're dealing with here, and why what happens next in this case was allowed to happen in the first place, and just how quickly it spiraled out of control. So by the 1950s, Sauk County, Iowa was on the up and up as the next big metropolis and the place to be for growth and prosperity. Established in 1854, Sauk County quickly exploded into a bustling city. By 1950, its population had grown to 84,000, making it the second biggest city in Iowa at the time. It earned the nickname Little Chicago for its extravagant buildings and urban living, and it gained a reputation as being a working man's town as thousands of families began to settle in the area following World War II. It was a tight-knit community soon formed amongst the newly arrived families as community theaters and sports stadiums began to quickly pop up, and just a genuine sense of community began to blossom. It became the true definition of an all-American town as high school football became the place to be on Friday nights, and the doors remained unlocked at night due to just how safe and secure the entire city seemed to be. Now, it seemed like nothing bad could happen here. So with that, that leads us to August 31st, 1954, the day that would change Sauk County, Iowa forever. A child goes missing and would ignite a chain reaction of hysteria and injustice and lead to the arrest and conviction of at least 20 innocent men. So Tuesday, August 31st, 1954, was a pretty average day for the vast majority of it for the Bremers family, who resided in Sauk County, Iowa. Joseph and Dorothy Bremers were spending the week building their new home they had just bought the land for. The two were building it together brick by brick to save money while living in their small and more modest home located just a few miles away with their three children, 14-year-old Karen, 12-year-old Patricia, and 8-year-old Jimmy. Now, the two had taken the week off from work to get a jump on building the house, spending their days driving back and forth between the two locations to check on their children from time to time. The couple returned to their current home at about 5:30 p.m. to have dinner with the children, and as they finished up, the couple prepared to return working on their new home, and at this point, normally Jimmy would go with them so they could kind of keep an eye on him. However, that night, he instead asked his mother if he could go visit his friend Joey Hamill, who lived just two houses down from the Bremers. Now, Dorothy said yes, and honestly, she didn't give it much more thought as she and Joseph left out the door. The family lived in one of those nuclear family-centric neighborhoods like I was talking about earlier, where everyone looked out for one another. All the women were homemakers and stayed home and would be out and about taking care of dinner and the kids, and they all kind of just acted as motherly figures for the younger kids. You know, they'd always peek out their windows, keep an eye on everyone's kids as they ran around and played in the neighborhood. And if anything was amiss, their parents would receive a call in 5 minutes flat.
Yeah, it's like one of those neighborhoods where everybody knows each other.
And everyone did legitimately know each other. So the neighborhood where they were located was kind of isolated from the rest of the city, and there wasn't much foot traffic or vehicle traffic through there. And if there was, you knew about it immediately. Because, of course, gossip was a favorite pastime for a lot of housewives, and so everyone knew everybody, and if a stranger was passing through, everyone knew it within minutes. Again, nobody locked their doors or their cars, and it was just a simpler time where the idea of serial killers and murderers coming into your home or just even on your street was completely non-existent. Now, Jimmy was also a very obedient and respectful kid, even at 8 years old. His mother would later state that he never gave them any worries, he always made sure to come home before dark, was very soft-spoken and polite, and he never did anything without asking his mom for permission first. Dorothy also knew that Jimmy didn't have many close friends, as he actually suffered from a stutter that, of course, caused him to be teased in school. Because remember, kids can be shitheads.
Even in the 50s.
Even in the 50s. So she knew that time with the one close friend he had was important, as the two would be starting second grade the following week. Now, Dorothy had actually also suffered 6 miscarriages before Jimmy, all of them boys. So she went through a lot of pain and heartbreak before having Jimmy, and he immediately became her miracle baby, and she would give him the world if she could. Sadly, this would be the last time Dorothy or Joseph would see their son alive. So Jimmy walked over to Joey's house, and there a group of boys had gathered to check out the Hamill family's brand new television set, which at the time was a very hot commodity and something many families still didn't have, so this was a very big deal. All the kids to gather to check out the new neighborhood TV. The boys sat in front of the TV watching Make Room for Daddy and Juvenile Jury, and by 8 p.m., Life with Father had just come on, and this is when the boys decided it was getting late and probably time to head to their respective homes. Now, this is important because it helps establish an exact time frame of when Jimmy would go missing. One of the boys that night, 13-year-old Stephen Counterman, would later state that as everyone was leaving and he began his walk home, he turned back to see Jimmy, wearing only his sneakers and blue jeans with no shirt, standing by a tree in the Hamill family's front yard. Now, Stephen would later recount how he found this very odd, as everyone else was making their way home, and Jimmy was just simply standing there, not doing or saying anything. Stephen waved and shouted goodnight to Jimmy, who did the same back before again going back to just standing there by the side of the street. This would be the last confirmed sighting of Jimmy Bremers alive. Now, when Jimmy failed to return home, his parents immediately knew something was wrong, and they wasted no time contacting police. Now, this isn't like how it is today. Kids just not coming home or possibly running away wasn't really a thought, especially in Sioux County. So a search was immediately launched at daybreak the following morning. Hundreds of volunteers gathered all over the city and scoured every last corner they could find looking for Jimmy. Members of the National Guard and troops from a nearby Air Force base actually formed search parties as well. Military helicopters flew overhead with Joseph and Dorothy inside them, looking over every body of water and open field within a 3-mile radius of their home. For 2 days, they searched every last barn, river, field, and empty building for Jimmy, but they found absolutely nothing. It was as if he had vanished into thin air. So that shows you how legit this is. The National Guard and the Army immediately joined in the search for this kid. And I think that really just shows you how close and tight-knit this community truly was. Like, everyone, like, Jimmy going missing was like everyone's child going missing. And so everyone took it very seriously. Now, following this initial search, Dorothy publicly stated, "I know in my heart that he's been kidnapped. That's the only explanation for why he hasn't come home." Local law enforcement began to turn their attention to looking at foul play and searching for possible suspects. They announced in the local paper 3 days after Jimmy disappeared that they were looking at all the local, quote-unquote, moral offenders in the area and that it's possible a sex fiend took Jimmy. Now, what police left out in this statement was that they had already had a suspect in custody and they were positive they had their guy. So on Wednesday, September 1st, the morning after Jimmy disappeared, police received a phone call from a concerned citizen who stated they knew of a strange man who was in the area around the time of Jimmy's disappearance. A man named Arthur Misk, who lived on Castleman Street just a few blocks from the Bremers' home, would tell police that just a few hours before Jimmy went missing, he received a knock on his door from a strange man he had never seen before. The man was 50-year-old Ernest Triplett Jr., a traveling musical instrument salesman that worked at the local Flood Music Store in Sioux County. Now, part of Ernest's job was to travel around all over the city and visit as many homes as he possibly could to see if they wanted to sign their kids up for music lessons with the store before the school year started. Now, at a little past 7 p.m., Ernest arrived at the Misk home by mistake. He was looking for their neighbors, the Osbournes, as he was going to drop off an accordion for their son that they had just bought him. However, he misread the address, and seeing that the Miskes had a son, he asked if they would like to sign him up for music lessons as well, and they agreed and invited Ernest inside. Now, although he didn't say or do anything out of the ordinary, Arthur would later state that something just felt very off and disturbing about the man. He also made it a point to note that part of this was because he noticed that Ernest wasn't wearing socks. So, like, he was dressed pretty fancy, yet he had no socks on, and for some reason, that really disturbed Arthur.
Actually, I've always heard that if you're suspicious of someone, like, trying to hustle you or something like that, always take a look at their shoes, because a lot of times there'll be somebody in fancy dress, and then you'll look at their shoes, and they will not have nice shoes on. And it's actually saved me once when I was visiting, like, a large city and everything. There was a guy saying he needed help getting into a car, which I was very suspicious of anyway. But I looked at his shoes, and he was, like, in a suit and everything, and he had tennis shoes on. And I was like, that's a little... But he had, like, tennis shoes on with a suit. And I was like, are you sure this is your car? And he's like, oh, yeah, I just need some help getting into it and everything. And I was like, you know, this just seems already weird to me. But the shoe thing actually sealed the deal, and I just walked on. So maybe there is something to that. No socks, no shoes. Maybe you're creepy.
So that's okay. I understand that part. I've always heard the saying, like, you can tell a lot by a man from his shoes or something like that. So that makes sense. But at first, just reading that, because he even would later testify in court, he's like, I knew the man was guilty the minute I saw he had no socks on. And I was like, it's just such a interesting way to clock somebody. Ernest left their home at around 7:55 p.m., just 5 minutes before the last reported sighting of Jimmy a few blocks away. Now, following this tip from Arthur, investigators quickly set out to bring Ernest in for questioning and tracked him down at the music store where he worked, and they brought him down to the Sioux City Police Station, where he would remain for 2 weeks without any lawyer or legal counsel given to him, while police subjected him to hours of grueling interrogations. Now, Ernest showed no signs of stress or worry about being brought in by police, and he constantly stated he was innocent and he had no idea what happened to Jimmy. However, this was called into question as Ernest's story would change over and over and over and over again. At first, he stated he did in fact see Jimmy the night he disappeared, and that he had actually stopped and asked him if he wanted to sign up for music lessons, but Jimmy politely declined, and Ernest kept on driving. But in another story, he stated he saw Jimmy walking along a ditch, and when he stopped to check on him, Jimmy stated he was running away from home. In another version, he stated he watched as Jimmy ran inside a house, put on a shirt before running back outside and around the back of the house, only to disappear. In yet another version of his story, he stated he saw Jimmy walking and offered him a ride home. Jimmy agreed and got into the car before abruptly telling Ernest to stop, at which point he ran from the car and behind a nearby house. Now, one thing police agreed on was that no matter the story, Ernest did in fact see or had some sort of interaction with Jimmy that night, as he knew details that hadn't been released to the public, such as the fact that Jimmy wasn't wearing a shirt when he vanished.
He sounds guilty to me just from that, or at least very suspicious, especially him changing his story a lot.
He is a very suspicious man, and I'm not saying he didn't do it, but here in a minute you are going to get more light on why he is acting so shady. He is a shady character through and through, but is he a child murderer? We will see. So even though they agreed that he had to have seen Jimmy in some sort of capacity, there wasn't actually any sort of evidence that linked him to Jimmy's kidnapping, and they were starting to get frustrated with his changing story. Now, even with nothing to actually hold him on, Ernest was not allowed to leave the station and refused access to legal help. Now, the Sioux County PD during this time had a bad reputation for being brutes and bullies towards suspects, and they were known to be rough and very physically violent with people. And at the time, it was actually like they didn't care what your education was or your background. The only people they would hire was tall, big, buff, burly men, so they could have a sense of like threatening aura about them anywhere they went, and people wouldn't mess with them and would talk, and they could just beat the shit out of people. Now, one of the most feared investigators in the city was a private detective named Joseph Matusik. He was known to get confessions out of even the toughest of criminals, and police allowed him to interrogate Ernest for several days. Days. Now, by the end of it, Joseph suggested to Ernest that he could make the interrogation stop just by admitting what he did, and that at worst, he'd probably just go away to the nearby Cherokee State Mental Hospital for a few years for evaluation. Ernest told Joe that he'll sign a written statement admitting to whatever police wanted him to admit to, but he needs them to tell him how they think Jimmy died because he doesn't know. By the end of it, Joseph concluded that although Ernest was a strange and suspicious man, he didn't have any knowledge of what actually happened to Jimmy Brimmers. So that's your first little, your little nugget of truth there. So before we go any further, let's tell you a little bit about Ernest Triplett. Now, not much is known about his early life other than that he didn't have the best upbringing. He was born in Woodbine, Iowa, and dropped out of school in the eighth grade. He was unable to read or write without assistance from another person, and everyone who met him described him as, these are their words, not mine, they described him as dim and simple-minded. He would later state he was signed up for the Army against his will, and he went AWOL just 4 months into training. He spent his time traveling all over the state doing odd jobs in order to survive, including a carnival, a pool hall, and at a saloon where he met and married a sex worker. Now, around this time, Ernest made money by hanging out in local parks known for being gay cruising spots, and he allowed men to perform oral sex on him in exchange for money. During this time, he was arrested on several occasions from everything ranging from vagrancy to pimping to lewd acts with another man. Eventually, he divorced his first wife and moved to Portland, Oregon to help paint Navy ships following Pearl Harbor, where he met and married another woman and adopted her three kids. Now, for a time, Ernest was living a pretty good life and even bought his family a home. Eventually, however, his new wife got sick of him and kicked him out, and he was once again living life on the road, making money however he could. He hitchhiked and made his way to Sauk County, Iowa on August 4th, just 3 weeks before Jimmy went missing. Now, one thing that people who knew Ernest well would later state is that above all else, he loved attention. He loved being the center of attention for people, and he would do anything to get it, which included lying and making up grand jury stories that were not true. So that's where a lot of people go, like, it's weird his story is changing, but a few things to keep in mind from people that knew him well is like, one, he is not the most well-educated, and they did think he had a mental handicap of some sort. And on top of that, he loved attention. And so they think maybe the attention he was getting may have caused him to change his story a lot. Or maybe he did do it. And this is where the real controversy starts popping up. Now, eventually, after over a week without getting much information out of Ernest in relation to Jimmy, police started to ask questions unrelated to the young boy, questions about Ernest's past arrest for quote-unquote acts of perversion with men. Now, Ernest was very honest with investigators as he talked about trading sex for money with men and that he did have sexual feelings for both men and women. He talked about his marriage to a sex worker, as well as several hookups he had in the past with random men. He also disclosed that when he was 9, he had been sexually assaulted by an older boy in a barn. Police immediately latched onto these details as being a motive for Ernest kidnapping and murdering Jimmy, releasing an official statement in the local paper. Remember, they have no actual evidence. Releasing a statement in the paper where they called him a sex pervert and deviant, and that he committed the kidnapping to satisfy his perversions. Now, as part of his job as a traveling music salesman, Ernest had dozens of young boys and girls in and out of his car every single day, as he showed them different instruments for them to try. Now, although police tried to say he used his job to prey and abuse young boys, Ernest maintained that he never did anything inappropriate with children and that there was always a parent present nearby to attest to that. Now, as far as we know, no reports ever came to light of any kids stating Ernest abused them. Still, this did not stop police from continuing to zero in on Ernest as their prime suspect. But it was already going on a month of unlawfully detaining Ernest without any actual evidence linking him to the crime. They knew they'd have to do something, and that's when on September 16th, they offered to allow him to willingly check himself into Cherokee State Mental Hospital for evaluation and treatment. Ernest immediately agreed, and of course just wanted to be released from police custody, and he was moved into the facility to begin his stay. Again, without any sort of legal counsel or help, Ernest was just wanting the interrogations to stop, but little did he know, he had just stepped into a trap, and it was about to get much worse. Police were glad he went willingly, as the state hospital was a great place to keep him while they continued their investigation, and now they no longer had to worry about keeping him detained themselves. But on top of this, they knew the Cherokee Hospital did not have the best reputation, and the staff there was notorious for their experiments on patients.
They knew this, and they were cool with it. Already, we got problems.
Of course they knew about it. They're like, if our interrogation isn't working, we can just turn them over to this state mental hospital where they're known to just practice all kinds of shit on the patients there. And they're like, maybe then he'll confess to this just so we can move him from there back into police custody.
Or he'll just die and we can say he done it.
Yeah, or he'll just die and we can say he did it. So founded in 1894, the hospital was located in the district of Cherokee, about an hour's drive outside of Sauk County, and it served to house patients from 94 different surrounding counties. Now, it is the 50s, and antipsychotics and depressants and tranquilizers were not in common use back then, so usually if a patient is sent to Cherokee, they're there for a while, or forever, depending on how bad their issues are. In order to keep costs down as much as possible, the staff and doctors there that worked were made up of almost exclusively immigrants who could not get jobs elsewhere due to their immigration status. This allowed the hospital to pay considerably less than other places, and it definitely led to not only resentment from the hospital staff, but also led to the hiring of some less than savory characters. One such character was a man named Dr. Anthony Sains, a Cuban-born immigrant who was described by those who knew him as an egomaniac. Now, Dr. Sains was a very mysterious and interesting man, to say the least. Not much is actually known about his background or how he even became a doctor, since after he was let go many, many years later, his residency certificate was found, and it turned out he had just stolen the certificate from another doctor there, whited out their name, and wrote his name over top of it. So, that's one way to become a doctor.
It's called Russell, Hustle, and Bustle.
And the messed up part about that is even after that was discovered, the administrative staff there actually called him up a few months later and was like, offered him his old job back just because they didn't give a shit. Now, Dr. Sains was obsessed with any and everything new and popular in America, from having the newest car to studying the newest experimental medical treatments. One treatment he became very obsessed with was using hallucinogenic drugs to treat mental illness, in particular, the use of LSD. Again, this is the 50s, and we are still a ways away from LSD being associated with hippies and being considered bad. At this point, hundreds of doctors all over the country were actually studying its effects, and all agreed that it was very useful in treating everything from depression to alcoholism. Dr. Sands was eager to test out the effects of LSD on patients and even mix and match it with other drugs to see if he could develop the perfect drug. Now, one of his patients would soon become Ernest Triplett, who just a week after arriving there was injected with three separate shots of LSD mixed with sodium amytal, or as it was better known back then,
truth serum.
Truth serum. Now, of course, this was done in an attempt to get Ernest to confess to kidnapping Jimmy, but instead of confessing, Ernest began complaining that he was having terrifying visions of Jimmy running along the road and even chasing after him. Jimmy chasing after Ernest, not the other way around. So this seemed to just be another dead end. By this point, police were actually ready to give up. On September 28th, they made an official statement that that day would be their last search effort for Jimmy, and if they didn't find him then they didn't believe they were ever going to bring him home, and that Ernest had committed the perfect crime. 200,000 people gathered and scoured over the city for any signs of the boy, but to no luck. By dusk, everyone had lost hope of finding Jimmy. But by dawn, on September 29th, things were about to change. The next morning, workers building a fence along a field in nearby Plymouth County stumbled upon the decomposing remains of a young boy in the middle of the field and quickly notified police. The location was just 4 miles away from the Bremers' home, and it seemed pretty clear right away that they had found Jimmy Bremers. Now, this part is pretty graphic and gruesome, so trigger warning. The entire upper half of Jimmy's body was found to be completely decomposed. His head was missing and discovered a few feet away, having been completely crushed and caved in from blunt force trauma, and his hands had been cut off and were missing and to this day have never been found. Within 2 hours of the body being discovered, police rushed to Cherokee Hospital and pulled Ernest out to drive him to the location of where the body was found. Now, after arriving at the spot, investigators took Ernest to the field and asked him to explain to them what happened there. Ernest was confused and denied knowing of anything happening there. Officers let him walk around the area for a bit before finally revealing to him, this is where they found Jimmy. Now, investigators were even more suspicious of Ernest after, according to them, immediately after being let out of the car, he made his way up to the only spot from the road where Jimmy's body would have been visible that far in the field. Which, now that seems pretty shady, except many years later, Ernest was finally asked about this, and he stated, it was because I could see reporters and crime scene techs huddled around that specific spot in the field, so I wanted to get a better look at them. So that makes more sense. But of course, back then, police were like, we didn't tell him anything, and he immediately walked to the only spot from the road where you could see this little boy's body. Of course, he had to be the killer. But it's like, well, you also have a dozen people in this one specific spot, so that's naturally where I would go look too. But again,
it's how you sell it.
It's how you sell it. Ernest also revealed, though, that he didn't have great memories of that day to begin with, because right before being taken from the hospital by police, Dr. Sands injected him with LSD, speed, and an unknown barbiturate. He had also not been allowed to eat for 3 days before being injected with these drugs. So, yeah, the man was completely out of his mind. Again, this information would not come to light until decades after the fact. Instead of being taken back to the hospital, Ernest was taken back in for more questioning. Police Chief James O'Keefe told local reporters at the scene that they were confident Ernest was their guy because he was a quote-unquote psychotic homosexual that killed Jimmy for sexual thrills, further inciting a panic in the town for their fear that sexual perverts were after their children. And again, Sioux County, Iowa was considered the perfect all-American town. Nothing bad happened here. And it would be one thing if it was just a simple murder, but the kidnapping and the horrific murder of a child just absolutely sent this whole city into hysteria. And the cops aren't really helping much when they're like, there's sexual perverts amongst us. It could be anyone. It could be your neighbor. It could be your barber. And that, of course, is just making people even more panicked and terrified and angry. Still, not everyone in the town actually was convinced of Ernest's guilt. By this point, it was known that Ernest had been unlawfully detained for almost a month without legal counsel, and many lawyers were outraged over this fact, with several demanding they be allowed to speak to him. Now, several lawyers did speak to Ernest and offered their services to him, but oddly, he turned them all down. Now, this shocked everyone, and it seemed really weird, with Ernest later telling them that if he was released, he'd have nowhere to go back to, since he was out of a job and a place to stay, and that's why he wanted to stay in police custody. Except Ernest himself would later state many years later that the truth of the situation was he did this in a naive attempt to prove to detectives that he was innocent and that he didn't have anything to hide and he didn't need a lawyer. So it kind of makes sense when you look at it that way. Again, Ernest was very naive. He didn't, I don't think, fully understand what the cops were doing to him. And of course, he wanted to believe, you know, they're here to help us. They're going to do everything they can to prove who really did it. And I didn't do it. So, of course, I'm going to eventually be let go. And I don't think he fully grasped at the fact that they're just going to railroad him if he didn't do it. So, yeah, I don't think he realized that by this point, cops had his number, if not for anything else than the fact that he was a sex pervert for being a homosexual. So it was sad because I also don't think the lawyers knew his background. And on top of this, he's being starved and constantly drugged. So Lord knows what is going through his mind at this point. And I think that's the sad and tragic thing, too, is, again, he's being tortured for over a month at this point, on top of having mental struggles and issues and not really fully grasping the whole scope of the situation. And there's not much you can do at that point. I mean, if he doesn't want a lawyer, he doesn't want a lawyer. But at the same time, I don't think he understands that he needs a lawyer. And so it was a very frustrating situation all around. Now, on October 6th, he was involuntarily committed to Cherokee Hospital and again subjected to starvation and being injected with copious amounts of drugs on a daily basis. Police continued to interrogate him at the hospital over the course of a week for hours at a time. He at first again maintained his original story that he had given Jimmy a ride to his house before watching him run around behind it and disappear. Now, by the third day of interviews, Ernest finally stated that he did in fact murder Jimmy, telling officers that he drove Jimmy to the field and attempted to unzip his pants. When he fought back, he killed him to keep him from talking. Investigators took a short break before returning with a hidden tape recorder and asked Ernest to repeat that version of the story, which he did. For the next 5 months, Ernest was kept at the hospital while police strengthened their case against him. He was subjected to routine injections of LSD and other drugs and eventually deemed sane enough to mingle with the general population of the mental hospital. Ernest adjusted well to life at the ward, and he was deemed by multiple doctors and staff members as being an ideal patient, often helping with chores and work around the ward. And following his last confession, Ernest went back to maintaining he had no involvement with Jimmy's murder and that his confession was coerced, which I 100% believe.
Yeah, but that's really hard to change once confession comes out, even with facts coming out later that would disprove it. A lot of people's like, then why would you confess? Why would you do it?
Especially if it's recorded. So, again, they had his number.
I mean, he was also on LSD at the time of the confession and everything, which I would hope in today's times would mean something, but hey, you never know.
Well, that actually plays a very important part later on because it's something that was conveniently left out of the original trial.
I'm sure it was.
And did not come to light for almost 30 years. But now, at this point in the story, Ernest still hasn't been charged with any crime. He has been involuntarily committed to Cherokee Hospital, but he's adjusting to life there. They're kind of pulling back the doses of LSD they're giving him. And he was actually such a model patient that he was actually granted release from the ward to go visit family for Thanksgiving. And he actually returned on his own volition 3 days later. And again, that seemed really odd too. That like they just let him go and they're like, be back here in 3 days for your release. But again, Ernest didn't fully know, like, okay, I'll go and do that and return. And I'm just, eventually they'll let me go because they know that I didn't actually do it. Now, by January 1955, doctors deemed Ernest completely sane and cured, and they began the process of releasing him. However, upon learning of Ernest's impending release, the Sauk County District Attorney at the time, Don O'Brien, petitioned the hospital to keep holding Ernest while police created a strong case against him. Don was actually running for mayor at this point, and one of the biggest talking points for every candidate running was how they planned to clean up crime in the city to protect kids from suffering the same fate as Jimmy Brimmer's. Don took it a step further and announced he was actually going to clean the city up of sexual deviants, aka homosexuals like Ernest Triplett. Now, this tactic worked, and Ernest was held for several more months until March 3, 1955, when he was officially arrested for the murder of Jimmy Brimmer's. Ernest pled not guilty, and his trial was one of the most sensational events to happen in Iowa's history at that time. So even though investigators begged the hospital to keep holding Ernest while they gathered evidence against him, by the time he was arrested and went to trial, they had uncovered literally zero new evidence tying him to the murder. No blood was found on his car, no murder weapon or blood was found on his clothing, and no eyewitnesses placing him anywhere near where Jimmy was last seen. The only thing they had was that taped confession and the fact that his story changed a bunch of times. And again, they also made sure to conveniently leave out the fact that Ernest was starved and drugged out of his mind during the confession. Ernest's trial began on June 8th, with Ernest himself being represented by a public defender named Thomas Tacy. Now, Tacy did not have the best track record with the court, as just 4 years prior, he had actually lost his license to practice for a time due to taking money from clients and then failing to provide them with legal services. So we're off to a great start here. He had also never actually went to law school. He just took the bar exam and somehow passed. And remember, this is the 1950s, so it's kind of like, yeah, I mean, if you can pass the bar exam, sure, you can be a lawyer. You don't need, like, 12 years of training. Now, as expected, the prosecution's whole case relied on Ernest's quote-unquote sexual deviancy and his homosexuality as being the motive. Prosecutors thought that this would be an easy tactic to use with a jury made up exclusively of church-going small-town folk. Multiple witnesses were called to testify, starting with the local coroner, Thomas Carradine, who described how Jimmy had been killed by having his skull crushed with a lofty object similar to a large stick or mallet. He also noted that the zipper of Jimmy's shorts had been undone by about an inch, but no other signs of sexual assault were present. Arthur Misk was also called to testify, along with Dorothy and Joseph Brimmers, as well as several investigators and detectives who gave statements regarding how Ernest went directly to the only spot in the field where Jimmy's body would be visible, and also about his quote-unquote immoral sexual activities with men. A woman was also actually called to testify and stated that she thinks Ernest may have tried to kidnap her son the day before Jimmy disappeared. He was in her home talking with her son about music in the living room. When she got up to get refreshments and came back, she saw Ernest with his hand on her son's wrist, which he quickly pulled away as she entered the room. Now, of course, I think that's a bit of a stretch for her to say he was attempting to kidnap her son. I'm not saying that he may not have been trying something, but to get on the stand and be like, he attempted kidnapping right before Jimmy disappeared. Now, through all of this, Ernest's lawyers maintain that they're not there to argue whether or not Ernest was an immoral character. They're like, he is. You know, he is a sexual deviant, whatever you want to call him. He has relationships with men, but that's literally not what we're here for. We're here to see if he killed a little boy, and the prosecution has actually zero actual evidence tying him to the crime. And at one point, Tacy, Ernest's lawyer, even suggested that Joseph Brimmers may have killed his own son due to having him taken out life insurance policy on all three of his kids, which is a bold thing to do. Of course, I think he was trying to throw suspicion like it could be anyone, but it really only did more to
incite everyone
and make them more sympathetic to the prosecution and the Brimmers' cause. But again, Tacy passed the bar exam without going to law school, so, you know. But now, at one point in the trial, of course, the tape confession was brought out for the entire jury to hear. On it, Ernest, who spoke in a much deeper and drowsy-sounding voice, told investigators the story of how he drove Jimmy to the field and the two stepped out of the car. Ernest stated he attempted to kiss Jimmy and undo his pants when the young boy pushed him off and began running through the field. Ernest chased after him and smacked him across the head with his hand, causing him to fall and hit his head on a rock. Jimmy was unresponsive, and Ernest believed he had killed him, so he dragged his body further into the field and left it there before driving off. Now, although he confessed to this story, it didn't line up with how Jimmy actually was killed, considering his entire skull was literally caved in.
That's what I was going to say. Like, he fell and hit his head on a rock and his skull caved in.
So even with the tape confession, it didn't line up with what the coroner's report found. That doesn't happen from just hitting your head on a rock. So Ernest himself actually took the stand, and he proclaimed that the entire thing was a lie and he had no involvement with the murder. Now, again, this is a frustrating part, and it's kind of one of those things, like, there were many times things could have been brought up. So Ernest didn't do himself any favors because he either didn't remember or forgot to bring up the fact that the confession had been given while he was heavily drugged. And of course, the prosecution's not going to do it. Ernest had the chance to do it, and honestly, that probably would have helped him out a lot. But again, he was not the most well-educated. He, of course, had issues, and his brain was fried from all the drugs they had given him. And he was still very much faithful to the investigators and prosecutors, and he very much believed, like, they're going to do the right thing. Like, they know I'm innocent. Like, this is just a formality or something. So Ernest didn't do himself any favors. He was combative towards his own attorney. He went on rambles and tangents unrelated to the case. And at one point, he even tries to defend the investigators who interrogated him, stating they were just doing their job. So it was obvious that Ernest was suffering either from some sort of mental impairment or his brain had just been that fried from all the drugs they'd given him. But either way, even with his weird ramblings, Ernest maintained he did not kill Jimmy. And so that's a frustrating thing too, is like he wasn't very helpful in defending himself. But again, it's just one of those things. I don't think he didn't have the ability to properly defend himself. Ernest stated that on that night, after leaving the Misc home, he drove back into town and stayed at a nearby hotel where he drank and listened to Liberace on the radio before passing out at about 8:30 p.m. Little did he know, him admitting he liked Liberace would be a major turning point in this case. So above all else, Liberace is what was the turning point of this case.
Honestly, as soon as you said Liberace, like, Liberace is kind of synonymous with gay.
It is, and it literally, like, it's so weird that, like, everyone agrees, like, it was the fact that he brought up Liberace that, like, changed the whole case for everybody.
I honestly have never heard Liberace or seen anything by Liberace, but the only thing that I would, like, think of when I heard Liberace was gay.
Well, I'm glad you think that, because people were thinking that all the way back to the 1950s. So, following this statement, the local newspapers had a field day with the story, and they began to compare Ernest to the flamboyant pianist and how this only proves his guilt as a homosexual and that the murder was most definitely sex-related. So, of course, at this point, he got prosecuted for, you know, having sex with men and stuff like that. But these charges were from, like, almost 20 years before, so it's kind of like, After the trial, one juror was even interviewed, and he stated, and I quote, "They actually had a pretty weak case against him. There was no actual evidence. But he admitted he loved Liberace in court and that he listens to him on the radio. A man who does that is liable to do anything."
See, that's kind of crazy, because Liberace was on the radio. If that was the, like, common conception, why was he on the radio?
I mean, he was still pretty popular, I guess. Honestly, I don't want to speak too much on it. I don't know that much about Liberace other than his name and that he was famous. But
yeah, and that his name somehow is synonymous with being gay. Maybe this is where that comes from. I have no idea, but literally, that's all I know, is somehow Liberace is synonymous with being gay.
But again, it's so weird. Like, the jurors openly admitted afterwards, they were like, honestly, like, up to that point, I thought the prosecution did a pretty poor job of proving he was guilty. Like, there was no actual evidence. But then
he likes that gay shit.
He admitted in court that he liked Liberace. And at that point, I was like, the man's guilty. Send him to the electric chair. Actually, send him to the noose, because at this point, hanging was still the main method of execution in Iowa. Now, several witnesses were also called in to defend Ernest, including his employer, who stated he was a model employee and that they had never received any complaints about him. But now, this is the one that gets me, and it's never brought up again, but I'm kind of like, how do you just gloss over that? So, a neighbor of the Brimmers was even called in to the stand to testify about his last sighting of Jimmy the night he disappeared. But get this, this same neighbor had actually confessed to police that he had been the one to kill Jimmy and had kept him tied up in his basement for several days before he killed him. But investigators dismissed this as crazy talk and they never pursued it.
What?
Yeah. So he openly went to police several weeks after Jimmy went missing, and he was like, it was me. And this is a neighbor, like, right across the street from the Brimmers.
which would put him in the right area to do this.
And he was like, yeah, I kidnapped him, kept him in my basement for a few days, but then the heat got too much, and so I killed him. And police, literally by this point, of course, they had Ernest, and they were like, it's just one of those crazy guys talking. He just wants attention. So they never pursued it. And this man is never named because he's never a suspect. So, yeah, there's that. And then he was brought into court to testify. And so it's, again, this is the 1950s, so it's a lot of weird shit.
But I mean, what did he testify to in court?
The last time he saw Jimmy, he was brought in. He was that close of a neighbor. He was brought in to be like, when was the last time you saw Jimmy on the night he went missing, to kind of establish a timeline? And he told them, but they conveniently left out the part where just a few months before, he admitted that he said that he was the one that killed Jimmy.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, that's one of those crazy little details. And it's kind of like, well, we have to go back to that. But sadly, they never go back to that. So we'll never honestly know. Maybe he was talking out of his ass. You know, a lot of cases like this that are this sensational always bring out those people that lie and try to get attention and stuff like that. So that may be all it was. But again, you never know because it was never pursued. Finally, on June 17th, the jury went to deliberate and returned 4 hours later with a verdict, and they found Ernest Triplett guilty of the murder of Jimmy Bremers. Jurors would later state that they all agreed he was guilty within 30 minutes of deliberating, and they spent the rest of the time deciding whether or not it was premeditated. They finally settled on charging him with second-degree murder and stated he had committed the crime in a quote-unquote "the excitement and frustration of an unsuccessful homosexual attack." Ernest himself did not seem to grasp the full scope of the situation, and after being found guilty, he turned to his lawyer and said, "Does that mean I have to stay here all summer?" Several weeks later, on July 7th, a judge officially sentenced Ernest to life in prison without the possibility of parole, stating, "You have led a life of sexual debauchery, and in my opinion, you are a perverted, depraved, and sadistic murderer, completely devoid of any sort of morals under the eyes of God or man." Ernest was transferred to Fort Madison State Penitentiary to live out the remainder of his days. His attorney began working to appeal the sentence, but even he openly admitted to reporters that it was unlikely anything would change. Following this, Sauk County started the healing process after nearly a year of demanding justice for the murder of Jimmy Bremers, and it finally seemed to have been served, and life could go back to normal. The sexual deviant was behind bars, and he was not getting out. But as the residents of Sauk County began to settle back into their normal routine, nothing could have prepared them for what would happen next. Just 3 days after Ernest Triplett was brought to Fort Madison to begin serving his sentence, on July 10th, 1955, Sauk County would be rocked to its core by the disappearance of yet another child. The details of this case were so shocking and horrific that the citizens of Sauk County went into a full-on frenzy as they demanded justice be served immediately to those responsible. Hysteria spread throughout the city, and what would start out as a genuine hunt for the culprit soon devolved into a witch hunt that rounded up and imprisoned as many sexual deviants as police could find, which we will be telling you about
next week. I was just about to say, you slipped a two-parter in on me again.
Next week. Actually, no. This is, technically it is, and it's not a two-parter. I don't think I'm going to call it a two-parter because it's technically unrelated. So the Ernest Triplett case, for right now, this is the Ernest Triplett case. And then what happens next is very much its own separate thing. It doesn't have anything to do with Ernest Triplett or really Jimmy Bremers, maybe, but it's still all surrounding the same town, the same time frame, the same events. And so the Ernest Triplett case was kind of like the match. And then next week is going to be the barn that match burns down, but it's technically unrelated. And so there's so many moving parts with this story. And I think that's one of the things that's so fascinating is it's not one thing or another. It's like this perfect storm of circumstances. So you have boy goes missing. They found this drifter who's a homosexual. they kind of railroad him. Even if he was guilty, they didn't do a very good job of proving it. This kind of agitates the town, and they're in a frenzy. But by the end of it, Ernest is convicted. He's sent off to jail to serve out the remainder of his day. So the town's kind of at ease again. And then immediately after he's convicted and they think it's over, another child murder happens. And this one is even worse. And at this point, the whole city goes into a huge hysteria, because it's one thing if someone's murdered in the perfect all-American town, but it's another thing if it's a child that's murdered, and it's another thing if it's a child that's murdered by quote-unquote sexual deviant, and then it's a whole other thing if multiple children are murdered over the course of just a year in this town that's supposed to be the safest place on earth. And so it's very much, and then after that, of course, like I said, the homosexual panic that follows, which is just where they kind of lose focus of their goal, which was to catch the culprit of the child killer. And by the end of it, they're just like, if you think they're gay, report it to police and we're going to arrest them and convict them.
All right, all right. You're getting too far into this. You're like all the new movie trailers that give away the whole story before you even get to see the movie. So I'm just going to wait till next week and you can explain it then.
Oh, I definitely explain. And that's not even scratching the surface of it. But I want to explain, like, I don't usually like doing too many two-parters, but I just had to due to the massive amount of info we have to cover and all the different moving parts with this case.
But I thought it wasn't a two-parter.
It's not technically a two-parter. And so that's the thing, is like, this is technically the end of this case, although Ernest Triplett does pop up again next week. So if you want to find out what happens to him, you do have to tune in. But I prefer two-parters over really long episodes that are like 2 to 3 hours long, just because I feel like I zone out in the middle of those. So I like breaking it up into nice little chunks. So hopefully you guys do too. But if you'd rather us just do mega-sized episodes that are like 2 hours long, let us know.
I don't want to do two-hour episodes, so please say no.
So there we go. Also, I think it just helps better keep track of where we are in the story. So again, yes, we will find out what happens to Sauk County in the immediate aftermath of Ernest being found guilty. We will eventually check back in with Ernest Triplett to figure out what happens to him and just close out this horrible chapter in queer history that isn't talked about enough and is sadly, for the most part, forgotten. But we're going to do our best to make everyone remember it. And so until next week, thank you guys so much again for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review or rating on iTunes or Spotify. Helps us out a lot, helps other people discover the podcast, and we love hearing your guys' feedback. Good or bad, hopefully it's good. If you want to see photos from this case, you can follow us on Instagram at Beers with Queers Pod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at Beers with Queers, a true crime podcast. And until next Monday, stay dangerous out there, my friends.
See you for part two.
It's not a part two, technically, but see ya.